From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Thailand's military declares martial law following a series of violent protests, but promises the situation is temporary as the international community looks on with concern.
We continue to urge the government to refrain from violence and respect human rights as well. We are encouraging all to do that, of course.
Also today, we look at why some of the UK's top politicians are careering from one gaffe to the next. And as the White House says the CIA will no longer use vaccination programs as a spy cover, we look at their lethal legacy in Pakistan.
That the harm in Pakistan has already been done. So in that sense, it's kind of an opportune time for the CIA to wash its hands of the problem by saying we're not going to do it again.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The U.S. government is just one of many calling for peaceful dialogue following the imposition of martial law by the Thai military. Thai military leaders are refusing to describe their action as a coup and insist it's only temporary and intended to restore order to a nation rent by political unrest. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has the reaction.
The head of Thailand's army says martial law will only remain in place until the country is safe and there is stability. The U.S. is urging respect for democratic principles. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
The U.S. firmly believes that all parties must exercise restraint and work together to resolve differences through peaceful dialogue to find a way forward.
The Obama administration says it expects Thailand's military to keep its commitments, that martial law is just a temporary action, and that elections should be held to determine the will of the Thai people.
Two blasts ripped through a busy bus terminal and market in Nigeria's central city of Jos on Tuesday afternoon, with police saying there were a number of fatalities. The attack came amid a bombing campaign by Nigeria's Boko Haram terrorist group, which has threatened to sell 300 abducted schoolgirls into slavery. The White House says the CIA has stopped using vaccination campaigns as a cover for spycraft. A fake immunization campaign was used to track down Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, leading to a Taliban backlash on health workers. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
A year and a half ago, the deans of 12 schools of public health wrote to President Barack Obama saying that public health programs should not be used for covert operations. Now, a letter has been sent to the deans saying that CIA banned operational use of vaccination programs last August and would not seek to obtain or exploit DNA or other genetic material acquired through such programs.
China and Russia were unable to announce an agreement on gas deliveries despite high hopes that the deal would be announced on Tuesday. A statement issued after the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping in Shanghai said that talks were continuing. The two countries have not been able to reach an agreement on the price of Russian gas for nearly a decade. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
A joint statement issued after the meeting in Shanghai said that natural gas supplies would start flowing as soon as possible, without providing further details. Russian President Vladimir Putin said after the meeting with his Chinese counterpart that he was glad to be informed that the two sides have made significant progress in the price negotiation of the East Route of the natural gas project. The agreement, which was expected to be signed during Vladimir Putin's visit to China, has been in the works for nearly a decade, as the two sides failed to reach a compromise on the price of Russian gas.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. Coast Guard is immediately resuming its search for four British sailors whose yacht capsized in the Atlantic. The search for the crew of the Cheeky Rafiki was halted on Sunday, but is getting underway again after pressure from Britain. Popular U.S. fast food chain Chipotle is asking its customers not to bring guns into its restaurants, even in states where it is lawful to carry firearms. The Mexican-style food chain had come under pressure to make the move after gun control advocates petitioned for a response to the gun group Open Carry Texas bringing assault-style rifles into a Chipotle in Dallas. American car giant General Motors says it's recalling another 2.4 million vehicles in the U.S., bringing the number of cars it's recalled so far in 2014 to more than 15 million. GM says it expects to take a charge of up to approximately $400 million U.S. dollars in the second quarter, mainly because of the cost of recall-related repairs. Switzerland's Credit Suisse Bank pleaded guilty to aiding U.S. taxpayers in filing false tax returns. It's the largest bank to plead guilty to criminal charges in over two decades. Patrice Howard reports from New York.
Switzerland's second-largest bank admitted to helping thousands of Americans hide their wealth. Prosecutors say Credit Suisse helped U.S. clients complete large cash transactions to avoid reporting their income to the IRS. Bankers also supplied credit cards tied to Swiss bank accounts and helped clients to file false tax returns. As part of a deal announced Monday, the bank agreed to one count of conspiring to aid tax evasion. Credit Suisse will pay about $2.6 billion in penalties, but won't be required to turn over the names of their U.S. clients. Patrice Howard, New York.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Royal Thai military has declared martial law following a series of violent protests. The army has promised the situation is temporary and both the constitution and the government are still nominally in power. But with the US embassy in Bangkok on alert and troubling reports of a media crackdown surfacing, our Washington correspondent Alice Olstein reports that American officials are following the situation closely.
Speaking to reporters in Washington about the evolving political crisis in Thailand, State Department spokesperson Jin Saki refused to say whether or not the action constitutes a coup.
The situation on the ground is very fluid. As you may know, martial law, the declaration of that is allowed for in the Thai constitution. But we're certainly closely watching what's happening on the ground and we'll continue to make evaluations.
Human Rights Watch and other international groups have called Thailand's martial law effectively a coup or a de facto coup. But the U.S. government, including the White House, said it's too early to say whether the move will trigger sanctions or the suspension of aid. White House spokesperson Jay Carney delivered President Obama's stance on the crisis.
The United States remains very concerned about the deepening political crisis there and urges all parties to respect democratic principles, including to honor its commitment to make, including respect for freedom of speech and freedom of the press. We expect the Army to honor its commitment to make this a temporary action to prevent violence and not to undermine democratic institutions.
Already, Thailand has seen major restrictions put in place on free expression, both in the streets and online. Fergal Barry Murphy, the editor of AsiaCorrespondent.com, told FSN what's happening on the ground.
There now have been 14 television stations shut down in the country, and the military has issued stern warnings against media freedom. These include against social media, to internet providers and social media users.
Describing an atmosphere that is more apprehensive than fearful, Barry Murphy outlined the options in Thailand going forward.
There could be two outcomes. One is that the army will facilitate an election, and August would seem like a realistic timeline. The other is that the army would push through an appointed government, an undemocratic government, not elected by the people.
As the imposition of martial law follows more than 6 months of anti-government protests and a decades-long history of repeated coups, officials both in the United States and around the world will be watching developments in the days to come. Alice Olstein, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. The White House says the CIA will no longer use vaccination programs as a cover for spying. The agency used the fake polio vaccination setup 3 years ago in Pakistan as part of the hunt for Osama bin Laden. The CIA campaign triggered a backlash from the Taliban, who targeted Pakistan's healthcare workers, killing dozens since 2012. Now the country is also in the grip of a polio crisis, a disease it had nearly eradicated just 3 years ago. Rafia Zakaria, a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper, spoke to me earlier.
Well, I mean, you know, instinctually, of course, it's always good when the CIA says they're going to stop doing something.
the problem, of course, in the Pakistani context is that the harm in Pakistan has already been done. You know, it's kind of spiraled, as you can see by the statistics of wild poliovirus in Pakistan. So in that sense, it's kind of an opportune time for the CIA to wash its hands of the problem by saying we're not going to do it again, because after the WHO directive that's declared, you know, this imposed restrictions on Pakistan, they probably suspected that this would get more media attention than it's managed to have in the past 3 years. And so, you know, one very neat way to kind of preempt that is to just simply say, well, we're just not going to do it anymore. But, you know, it's very much like saying, well, we killed a guy, but we're not going to kill another guy. Well, that guy's already dead, and, you know, there's no bringing that person back.
What exactly do you think this CIA program has meant for the spread of polio in Pakistan? Because 3 years ago, the country was on the verge of wiping out the virus.
You know, you have a situation where a fake polio and hepatitis B vaccination program was used to get this DNA. The public trust of ordinary Pakistanis in, you know, the viability of that vaccine or the purity of that vaccine has been assaulted. And now you've got a situation where a disease that was almost eradicated in that country has seen a wild resurgence. So, and, you know, and I mean, I've been writing and researching this ever since it happened. And initially, you know, the U.S. media especially was just caught up in such a haze of victory that nobody wanted to hear about it.
So what attempts are underway to win back that public trust in healthcare programs?
Well, you know, I mean, I wish I had an answer to that. One of the issues, of course, is just a resource issue. And I've written about this, and I really delineate this because people need to understand. So one, you know, the part that I just talked about was the public trust portion. The other portion is a structure and infrastructure problem. So the way Pakistan was delivering basic health care, especially to women and children in rural areas and in the inner city of big cities like Karachi, is that they use a program called the Lady Health Worker Program. Now, what has happened since the 2011 raid is that, first of all, you know, we talked about the public trust issue, but the second issue is, of course, that, again, lady health worker, women posing as lady health workers were used to infiltrate the compound. So now these health workers do not have access, as easy access to private spaces because they're believed to be CIA agents, all of them. And they're coming under attack with over 40 killed.
Rafia Zakaria, a columnist for Dawn, Pakistan's largest English newspaper. Now, the radical Islamic cleric Abu Hamza is now confronting the possibility of a life sentence in an American prison following his conviction on terrorism and kidnapping charges yesterday in New York. The cleric, who fought his extradition from Britain for 8 years, was found guilty of all 11 charges he faced after the prosecution successfully argued that he turned the Finsbury Park Mosque in North London into a base of operations for the global export of terror. Our US correspondent Simon Marks reports.
It was always going to be a long shot, but in the end, the Nelson Mandela defence didn't work. Abu Hamza's attorneys tried to draw a parallel between the late South African president and the cleric who once delivered fiery sermons at the Finsbury Park Mosque. Both argued the defence were freedom fighters accused falsely of being terrorists. Both were independent thinkers, not criminally minded extremists. The jury didn't buy it. After a day and a half of deliberations, Abu Hamza was convicted on all charges. His defense attorney, Joshua Dreitel, said the verdict was unjust.
This was a categorical verdict based on, as we've said before, a category of evidence that was not about conduct, that it was about his expression.
but jurors embraced the prosecution argument that Abu Hamza used the Finsbury Park Mosque as the base of operations for a global terror campaign. He was convicted of masterminding the kidnapping of 16 Western tourists in Yemen, of planning to build an Al-Qaeda training camp in the American state of Oregon, and of sending recruits to fight in Afghanistan. New Zealand scientist Mary Quinn, who was among the Westerners kidnapped by Abu Hamza, testified against him at the trial, and the US government offered protection to a number of other witnesses who offered evidence on the prosecution's behalf. The verdict was a victory for Manhattan's district attorney, Preet Bharara.
Abu Hamza, as the trial showed, attempted to portray himself as a preacher of faith, but he was, instead, a trainer of terrorists. That has now been proven in an American court to a unanimous jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Abu Hamza plans to appeal the verdict, which leaves him facing a life sentence in a U.S. jail. The trial's outcome is being celebrated by the authorities in New York, who earlier this year secured a conviction against Osama bin Laden's son-in-law. And politically, the jury's verdict helps President Barack Obama. He can point to both trials as evidence that the U.S. criminal justice system can handle complex terror cases. Another reason, he says, to close the detention center in Guantanamo Bay. Simon Marks, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. The United States Coast Guard has agreed to resume its search for four British sailors missing for 5 days in the Atlantic Ocean after their yacht capsized. The move follows a growing campaign backed by UK politicians and celebrities to carry on the search. The four men have been missing at sea since Thursday after their yacht, the Cheeky Rafiki, ran into difficulties hundreds of miles east of Cape Cod. The decision to reactivate the search was supported by marine explorer Jock Wishart, as he explained to LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz.
Well, my view is that we've seen Tony Bullimer survive down the South Atlantic for 5 days, and that's in much more severe conditions than they're encountering at the moment. You had a Mexican fisherman who's managed to survive 14 months at sea, so surely we can carry on a little longer.
The area of the sea we're talking about, Jock, the coldness of the water, the bad weather conditions, would it be possible to survive for a longish period?
Well, it has been done. It has been done. There are examples in the past of families, in fact, surviving. But there's not a great deal of hope. But while there's hope, you've got to try. And certainly what has not been done is that if we can somehow get, and it is a remote shot, get someone just to get to that hull and wrap on the hull and see whether anyone has survived in any of the air pockets. That's certainly something that should be done.
For the families of these men, though, Jock, obviously a dreadful time for them, wondering why this search was called off so soon. What do you think of the US's justification for pulling out, and do you think they are likely to restart the search?
Well, all you can do is put pressure on them to restart search. Remember, these are very, very experienced people. And one of the big issues is this. This is a long, long way out of helicopter range, so all you can use is planes to get out there. But as I said before, I still don't, it's certainly possible to divert a merchantman, and if the sea was calm enough, have a look at this, at the boat itself. Because what seems to have happened, and I'm just making an assumption here, is that the pictures show there was no keel on board the boat. And when the keel goes, there's nothing to balance the mast and sails. So the boat goes over very quickly. So there is a chance that they might be still underneath that boat.
Which would be wonderful, of course. Given the amount of lobbying, meanwhile, to get the search started, would you expect it to happen? Would you expect the US authorities to be taking notice of a petition?
Well, it's a lot of people asking for help, and stranger things have happened.
Jock Wishart talking to LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz. Now, it's been a day of gaffes on the campaign trail in the UK. On Thursday, British voters will go to the polls in European and local elections. But the leaders of the two parties expected by pollsters to come first and second in the European vote have had a difficult day, as Ollie Barrett reports from London.
The day didn't start well for Ed Miliband. Up bright and early, the Labour leader was busy telling Good Morning Britain how out of touch his political rivals are when the presenters pressed him on his shopping bill.
Now, how much do you know, do you think, about the actual cost of living, the average cost of living for people? Would you know, for example, what the average household grocery bill is per week?
Well, it depends on what you're, how much you're spending and how big
your family is. What's yours, for example?
Oh, look, we probably spend, you know, £70-80 a week on groceries at least, probably more than that. You know, so, but the point is that, you know, different families will have different costs that they face. But what I'm clear about is that there is a crisis facing so many people.
The average weekly bill for a family of four is more than £100.
Right, well, it's more
so
than that.
You're going to be spending significantly more than £70 or £80. I mean, people would say one of the problems with politicians is that they are actually talking about something but out of touch with the reality. And the, you know, the reality is much higher than you've just quoted.
Sure. Well, look, there's. Look, lots of people are facing real struggles, and I'm relatively comfortably off. But what I know is that there are deep issues that need to be tackled, and we're determined to tackle them.
His day didn't get better. A recording then emerged from a local radio interview on the campaign trail in Wiltshire.
What do you make of Jim Grant?
I beg your pardon?
Jim Grant. Do you think he's doing a good job?
I think that lots of Labour representatives are doing a good job right across the country, and I
you do know who Jim Grant is, Mr. Miliband?
Well, you'll enlighten me, I'm sure.
Swindon Labour leader.
Yeah, I think he's doing a good job, and I think.
Will he feel like you support him enough if you don't even know his name?
Well, he's doing a good job as leader of the council, Jim is, and I think that's the case.
I mean, is Swindon Labour leader, do you think by your comments now people might be a bit perplexed by why you wouldn't know who Jim Grant is?
No, I know that Jim is doing a good job for Swindon, and I think he's doing a good job as leader of the council.
But he's not the leader of the council, is he, Mr. Miliband?
Well, I think
it's a Conservative-led council.
No, I think he's doing a good job for Labour on the council.
Ed Miliband leads the opposition Labour Party, now advised ahead of next May's general election by US Democratic strategist David Axelrod.
Hi, I'm David Axelrod, and I'm proud to join the Labour team on behalf of Ed Miliband and his campaign for Prime Minister.
But their relationship's early days was marked by Mr. Axelrod tweeting his support of Mr. Miliband and spelling his name wrong. Ed Miliband's difficult day brings back memories of his predecessor as Labour leader, Gordon Brown, and a disastrous day campaigning for him when Prime Minister in 2010. He was filmed talking to a Labour supporter.
All these Eastern Europeans what are coming in, where are they flocking from?
But then his microphone was left on as he got in his car and drove away.
Good to see you all. Good to see you. Thanks very much. That's a disaster. Should never have put me with that woman. Whose idea was that? She's just this sort of bigoted woman.
Calling supporters bigots doesn't often go down well, and Mr. Brown was forced to visit Gillian Reynolds later in the day at her house to apologise.
I've just been talking to Gillian. I'm mortified by what's happened. I've given her my sincere apologies. I misunderstood what she said.
Gordon Brown lost the election. Returning to elections 2014, it's also been a tough few days for the anti-immigration, anti-EU UKIP party. Some polls have them winning the European elections, but leader Nigel Farage was criticised for what some felt were racist comments about Romanian immigrants in a radio interview with LBC.
What about the line about we're not wanting to live next door to Romanians? It's perfectly acceptable.
I didn't say that. I was asked, if a group of Romanian men moved in next door to you, would you be concerned?
What about if a group of German children did? What's the difference?
The difference, and you know what the difference is.
No, I honestly don't.
So in an effort to prove UKIP isn't racist, it organised a carnival in Croydon in South London, complete with a steel band. However, when the steel band realised they'd been booked for a UKIP carnival, they refused to play and left. Nigel Farage decided in the end not to turn up either. He and Ed Miliband hope the voters won't give up on them on Thursday. Ollie Barrett, London.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show that takes an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, a new exhibition in Washington, D.C., highlighting the prolific work of an American artist in Britain. An American in London has just opened at the Freer Sackler Gallery of Art here in the U.S. Capitol. It features a wide array of works by James Whistler, who spent a good part of the Gilded Age in the 19th century living in Britain. With more, here's a report from The Economist.
James McNeill Whistler is known as one of America's greatest painters, though he spent the majority of his creative years in London. As an American, Whistler could move freely among the British classes. He spent decades haunting the banks of the Thames, mingling with seedy wharf rats, or promenading among the elegant ladies with their parasols. His paintings, etchings, and drawings portray a city in flux, booming with industry and brimming with migrants. The river runs through nearly all of it. These works are the subject of an American in London, the biggest Whistler show in America in almost 20 years. Associate curator Lee Glazer coordinated the landmark exhibition for its presentation at the Sackler Gallery.
For Whistler, he was able to look at modern London in all of its hideousness, really, its grittiness, its dirt, its smog, its stench. And it wasn't something that most people wanted to look at, but somehow Whistler did. He was drawn to it and initially depicted it in all of its variety and grimy vitality and eventually in all of its poetry.
The show chronicles two dramatic changes. The first is what was happening in London in the 19th century, when industry and commerce transformed the look and feel of the surging city. In the dynamic painting, The Last of Old Westminster, workers are busily replacing the old wooden bridge with a modern wrought iron construction. It is a vital juxtaposition of old and new. The second change can be found in Whistler's own work as he began to borrow from the artistic language of Japanese woodblock prints. In thinly applied pinks, violets, and grays, Whistler summoned an almost otherworldly Thames. Women appear to wear kimonos.
We can literally chart Whistler's movement through London, through a changing London, and we can also chart his changing and evolving style.
The most startling works of this show are saved for the very end. Moody and hazy, in gauzy grays and blues, they are visions of the river at night. Whistler called these paintings and prints his nocturnes.
Just as in real life, it takes a few minutes to kind of discern shapes and forms and read them in the darkness, the same is true of the nocturnes. And the longer you spend with the pictures, the more those very specific landmarks begin to emerge.
But not everyone was pleased with Whistler's evolution.
To Victorian viewers who were used to very literary and morally uplifting canvases, these nearly abstract exercises in color seem perplexing and almost impossible to decipher.
John Ruskin, an important critic, lampooned Whistler for asking 200 guineas for flinging a pot of paint at the public's face. Whistler sued for libel and won, but he went bankrupt 6 months later. He continued working for another 25 years, yet little would ever rival the achievement of his nocturnes. These paintings presage not only the Impressionists, but also the Abstract Impressionists, who would shake things up decades after Whistler died in 1903. Like the Thames that runs through every one, these works will endure.
The exhibition is called An American in London. It's underway at the Freer Sackler Gallery here in Washington. You can find details of the exhibit online at asia.si.edu. That's asia.si.edu. And you can see some of the paintings by going to The Economist's website, economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Wednesday, how the future of the International Space Station has been pulled into the orbit of the Ukrainian crisis. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.